First Book of Kings, chapter 20, verse 1. And then Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his hosts together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots. And he went up and besieged Samaria, and warred against it. I want you to get this into perspective there. We read on. I think you do know that Ben-Hadad was one of the most powerful kings that Syria ever had. And Syria was just lying north of Palestine there, just beyond Damascus today. You'll find the Syrian desert, and this is where Syria was just at this particular time. Now down in Palestine, the 12 tribes were divided into two kingdoms. And there were two kings in the land and two royal cities. You'll find that Judah and Benjamin were in the south and called the southern kingdom. And the royal city was Jerusalem, of course. But the 10 tribes were nearer to Syria. And Ahab, that very wicked king, the man who did more to provoke God than any other king that Israel ever had, he was on the throne and he was reigning in Samaria. Of course, you do know that Jezebel was his wife, and you're bound to know that the chapters that go before 1 Kings 20 are 17, 18, 19, where Elijah came and upset Ahab and Jezebel. Now, you've got it now. So this Ben-Hadad comes with 32 other kings helping him, and he besieges Samaria. And it says, verse 2, and he sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, into the city, and said unto him, thus saith Ben-Hadad, thy silver and thy gold is mine, thy wives also and thy children, even the goodliest, are mine. And the king of Israel answered and said, my lord, O king, according to thy saying, I am thine and all that I have. And the great Ahab was frightened. He surrendered. And then it says, and the messengers came again and said, thus speaketh Ben-Hadad, saying, although I sent unto thee, saying, thou shalt deliver me thy silver and thy gold and thy wives and thy children, yet I will send my servants unto thee tomorrow about this time, and they shall search thine house and the houses of thy servants, and it shall be that whatsoever is pleasant in thine eyes, they shall put it in their hand and take it away. So you see, these terrorists, when they get an inch, they take a span. That's how they've always lived, of course. And that has been the trouble in our little province. We let them go too far, but I needn't start on that this morning. Like Ahab, we gave them a whole lot of things, but we needn't start on. Verse 7, then the king of Israel called all the elders of the land and said, mark, I pray you, and see how this man seeketh mischief. For he sent unto me for my wives and for my children, for my silver, for my gold, and I denied him not. And all the elders and all the people said unto him, hearken not unto him, nor consent. Wherefore he said unto the messengers of Ben-Hadad, tell my lord the king, all that thou didst send for to thy servant at the first I will do, but this thing I may not do. And the messengers departed and brought him word again. And Ben-Hadad sent unto him and said, the gods do so unto me, and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for all the people that follow me. And the king of Israel answered and said, tell him, let not him that girdeth on his harness boast himself as he that putteth it off. And it's a great word to remember. And it's especially a great word to remember for young preachers. You're just beginning to buckle on the harness. Don't be throwing your weight about too much, because you can't talk like him who's ready to take it off, because he's been through the battle, you know. And it came to pass, when Ben-Hadad heard this message as he was drinking, he and the kings in the pavilions, that he said unto his servants, set yourselves in array. And they set themselves in array against the city. And behold, there came a prophet unto Ahab, king of Israel, saying, thus saith the Lord, hast thou seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver it into thine hand this day, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord. And that's really surprising, because Ahab was the most wicked king. And yet the Lord has got to stand by him to deliver him. Don't make any mistakes about it. The Lord has a purpose in doing so. But we'll get it all as we go on, but I'm just marking that point. And Ahab said, verse 14, by whom? He's wanting to know by whom shall this great multitude be overcome. And he said, thus saith the Lord, even by the young men of the princes of the provinces. Then he said, that is, the king said, who shall order the battle? And the prophet said, thou. For Ahab was going to go out in the front of the battle. Then he numbered the young men of the princes of the provinces, and there were 232, and after them he numbered all the people, even all the children of Israel, being 7,000. Not altogether a great army, you know. And they went out at noon, but Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the pavilions, and the kings, the 32 kings that helped them, they were all nearly drunk. And the young men of the princes of the provinces went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told them, saying, these are men come out of Samaria. And he said, whether they be come out for peace, take them alive, or whether they be come out for war, take them alive. So these young men of the princes of the provinces came out of the city, and the army which followed them, and they slew every one his man, and the Syrians fled, and Israel pursued them. And Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, escaped on an horse with the horsemen. And the king of Israel went out and smote the horses and chariots and slew the Syrians with a great slaughter. Well, God was with him, and it was a wonderful day. Verse 22. And the prophet came to the king of Israel and said unto him, go, strengthen thyself and mark and see what thou doest. For at the return of the year the king of Syria will come up against thee. And the servants of the king of Syria said unto him, their gods are the gods of the hills, therefore they were stronger than we. But let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And do this thing, take the kings away, every man out of his place, and put captains in their room, and number thee an army like the army that thou hast lost, horse for horse and chariot for chariot, and we will fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And he hearkened unto their voice and did so. And it came to pass at the return of the year that Ben-Hadad numbered the Syrians and went out to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the children of Israel were numbered and were all present and went out against them. And the children of Israel pitched before them like two little flocks of kids, but the Syrians filled the country. And there came a man of God and spake unto the king of Israel and said, thus saith the Lord, because the Syrians have said, the Lord is the God of the hills, but he is not the God of the valleys. Therefore, I want you to get this, because the Syrians have said, not just coming out altogether to help Ahab, but because of what the enemy has said. You know, it's a very dangerous thing to say things against God, because God can hear you. And he heard the Syrians saying, the Lord is the God of the hills, but he is not the God of the valleys. Therefore, just because of that, will I deliver all this great multitude into thy hand, and ye shall know that I am the Lord. I don't want to read any more, because what we are going to do, we'll get out of what we have read. You see, I want to talk to you about the sin of the Syrians this morning. The sin that the Syrians committed. And it was a blasphemous sin. It was a particular sin. You know, we could all learn a great deal by just studying the sin of the Syrians, and then the sin of the Babylonians, and then the sin of the Egyptians, and the sin of the Canaanites, and the sin of the 10 tribes, and the sin of the 2 tribes. And you can learn a great deal by just looking up the sin of all these nations that sinned in a particular way against God. But we're just thinking about the sin of the Syrians this morning. And when I have explained what it was, and explained pondered all about it and examined it before you, I will have to say this, that the sin of the Syrians then can become the curse of the Christians today. That's the bit we're at. Because the sin of the Syrians then can become the curse of the Christians today. And this sin, it must be turned by grace into the voice of victory today, into the shout of salvation today, into the song of the saints, into the individual song. You must sing it for yourself. You must be able to voice this voice of victory for yourself. So that's what we're thinking about, the sin of the Syrians that could easily become the curse of the Christian, but must become the shout of salvation and the voice of victory for everyone. You see, the sin of Syria was just this, that they made their gods, gods of wood, and gods of stone, gods of silver and gods of gold. They made individual gods, and they placed some of them in a house, and he was the god of that house. He was the god of the house. And they placed some of them in the garden, and he was the god of the garden. And they placed some of them on a hill, and he was the god of the hill. And they placed a god in the valley, and he was the god of the valley. And you see, the sin of the Syrians was that they had a local god. He was the god of that particular locality. Whether it was house or garden or valley or hill. If you like, you can say he was a geographical god. Just over a certain geographical portion. And the sin was that they thought the God of Israel was the same. That he was just the God of the hills. Oh, but he's not the God of the valleys, so let's meet them in the valleys. And this is a terrible sin, because this provokes God. You see, somebody said somewhere, sometime, either that or I read it in the commentary, what does it matter what the enemy says? It matters to God. Because God has said here, because the Syrians have said, the Lord is the God of the hills, but he is not the God of the valleys, then I'll come and destroy these Syrians. You see, it is important just how you talk before God, you know. You see, they were just liking the living God, the Lord Almighty, the possessor of heaven and earth, the great I Am, the Creator. They were likening him to one of their images. And they had come to the false notion that he was the God of the hills, but he's not the God of the valley. And you know, God had heard them saying this. And I can tell you that's very important, you know. Because you remember when the sister of Moses spake against him because he married a colored woman. The book says immediately, and the Lord heard it. And she was stricken immediately. Because you need to be very careful what you say, you know. Because when Ananias and Sapphira stood up so piously and said certain things, the Lord was listening. And you have to be careful what you say about God before God. Because God will take you up on it. God is a jealous God. And he won't allow you to say whatever you like before him. Yes, you know when the Laodicean said, we are rich and increased with goods and need of nothing, the Lord Jesus bowed over the balustrade of heaven and said, you don't know that you're poor and blind and miserable and wretched and naked. He listens in, you know. You see, they were just making God the thought of local God. They were just making the geographical God over a little portion. And you know, this is the danger that the Christians are in today. You see, I listen sometimes to people talking, and you don't mind them talking about the past. But you know, they talk about the past, the wonderful days, the early church. And although there was persecution, how they overcame and how they were victorious. And they go into the revivals of the past, and they go into the mighty days of the past, and they go into the old preachers of the past. And they're always talking about the God of the past. And they start to try to keep him there. He's not sort of a local or geographical, he's a sort of historical God. And then they'll switch round, and they've got the whole future so clear, how you'll walk in through the pearly gates, and how you'll be in heaven, and all the glories, and they're talking about the final God. But they don't have an idea of the present God. He doesn't seem to be real to them at all. And I can tell you that the sin of the Syrians can become the curse of the Christians. Our God is the same today. He changes not. For God's sake, don't look too long at the past or too long at the future. God is here now. Don't worry about the IRA and the whole lot of other things. God is just the same today. I wish we could get it into our hearts and heads, because it would do us a lot of good. You see, there's the danger of thinking that our God is the God of the hills of the past. But he's not the God of the valleys of the present. That's it. Mind you, there's a lot of valleys around. You know, he's done mighty things in the past and he'll do mighty things in the future. We seem to have got the idea, at least this is the sort of way I feel that the talk goes. I hear them on the TV in the morning and it sort of irritates me, because you would think that the God of 59 must have died in 59, and you would think that the God who's going to open the pearly gates for eternity is just coming to alive then. Somehow he doesn't seem to be around today. This is not true. So let's get that. You would think that because of communism and Romanism and modernism and terrorism in the valley of the present that we haven't any God. Well, let's stop. Get our eyes on the God of this very moment. Oh, he's just the same today. You see, we must turn this curse that can be upon the Christians into the song of victory. Let's try to face the valleys of the present, you know. Yeah, there are valleys of the present, but you always find God there. You see, I can always see the Virgin Mary as a very young woman living in Nazareth. She was a virgin. I'm perfectly sure she was pure. And she must have been doing something in the home, whether it was dusting or cooking, I don't know. But an angel suddenly appeared. And I assure you that if an angel suddenly appeared in your kitchen tomorrow, frighten you. You would think it was a ghost of some kind. You would tremble, and so did she. And then the angel said to her, "Fear not, for thou shalt conceive in thine womb and bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus." Now you put yourself as a young woman in her place. And she's standing with her hands against the wall, frightened. This shining angel is saying, "Thou shalt conceive in thy womb and bring forth a son and call his name Jesus. He's to be the Messiah." And she said, "How can this be, seeing I know not a man?" That proves for all and sundry to me that she was pure. There is no woman in this world will face a shining angel and tell a lie like that. Oh, no, when she said to the angel, "I know not a man," you can be sure she knew not a man. No woman would dare to say. So she was pure. But she knew, if I give in to this, if I say, "All right, I'll be your servant and I'll bear this child, and I'll know not a man, and the Holy Ghost will come upon me, nobody will believe me." And immediately she was going to be in the valley of misunderstanding. And it's a deep valley. And I can tell you that if you're going to live right for God in the present, you're going to find yourself in the valley of misunderstanding. Your best friends won't understand you. Yes, folk that you love won't understand you. You've got to do something for God that God wants you to do, and you will be misunderstood. And you'll be way down deep in the valley, but you'll not be alone. The God who taught you and who is teaching you and is leading you will be in the valley with you. He happens to be the God of the valley in the present hour. Make no mistakes about it. And I'll tell you this, he will put an hedge about you that no man will be able to touch you. When Mary said to Joseph, "I'm going to have a baby," he says, "I'll put you away in a far country. I shall stone you." But God put a hedge round her. She was neither put away nor stoned. She was misunderstood for a moment or two. Oh, but God brought her through. You see, there is the valley of misunderstanding in the present, but God is there. There is the valley of sorrow today. Sure, I almost tremble as I talk about the valley of sorrow with folks sitting around me who know more about it than I will ever do. The week that I was preaching at Grogan, I agreed to meet a young woman at 7 o'clock one evening. And just 6 months ago, maybe less, 5 I think, her mother had been shot dead through the window by a gunman. Gunman came along and just put the gun at the window, shot the old lady dead, and the old lady was a saint of God. He made a mistake. He was at the wrong house. Old lady went to the brethren, loved the Lord, prayed. Everybody around the countryside knew she was a godly old soul. And this daughter of hers, she's a sister in the Royal Victoria Hospital, but she had never been able to go out of the house since. She just sat and cried. She couldn't understand it. And I said to the leader of the meeting, Elliot Gordon, I said, "Dear Elizabeth McMullen," they call the girl. "Yes," he says, "I do." I says, "You find her and bring her here." She says, "She won't come. She's never been out of her. She's rolled up in black clothes. You tell her I want to see her." And next night, 7 o'clock, I went early. I didn't know where she would come or not. She came in through the door. And I didn't need to ask. I could see the girl. Her face was trembling. I says, "I need to talk to you, Elizabeth. Shut the door." She says, "I can't understand why God allowed this." "So you do believe that God allowed it then?" said what you believe. You're not trying to say that he made a mistake or anything, are you? If he allowed it, he didn't make a mistake, did he? If he allowed it, he didn't cease to love your mother, did he? Let's get down to why he allowed it then.
Oh, took me a whole hour to tidy it out. At the end of it, I could see her. She said, Mr. God, you'd come and saw me the day she was shot.
I tidied it out for her. I let her see that God was really with her. When God allowed Joseph to go into the pit, allowed Joseph to go into prison, he hadn't forsaken him. He was guiding him to the net that he had for him. Oh, yes, I know, Mother. I went last Wednesday still Thursday, I'm not sure. See a man in Lisburn. He was shot out there at the factory gate some time ago. Old back blew right off him. Oh, poor creature, he has to go across the floor on his backside. He can't use his legs. He's only beginning to get up onto crutches for the first time after 9 months. And when I go in to see him, I knew the face. I said, yeah, I know you. Yes, I should think you do, he said. He said, I'm one of your converts. I was probably one of the first converts you ever had. You had a mission at Lisburn 35 years ago. I was 14 then. I was saved one of those nights. You're Norman Barr. Oh, it was Norman Barr, all right.
So I'll have to get down to start to talk to him about the two kingdoms and how God works his own will. And it took me a long time to tidy it out. And at last, his face broke into a smile. And his wife said, oh, Norman, you're smiling.
Oh, there is sorrow. It's all around us. You go down into the valley. So many of you can stand up and tell me more about it than I know. Oh, but God is with you.
He's in the valley. He'll see you through. And he'll see you through to the glory of his name, too. Yes, you know, when thou passest through the waters, you know the next bit of it, I will be with thee. I think some of you lose sight of it, and you think you're going through the waters on your own, and you're always talking about the God of the past and the God of the future, when he's right beside you in the water, up to the neck in the water with you.
He says, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers, listen to it, they shall not overflow thee. Never. It cannot be.
Oh, and there are valleys of persecution, you know. Because there are valleys of misunderstanding, and valleys of sorrow, and valleys of persecution. People don't persecute you now by putting your feet fast in the stocks. They just slander you behind your back. They just speak evil behind your back, and the devil helps them. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, you're like Paul, and you stand up, and you know that there are so many against you, and you look round for a friend, and he's not there. That my first answer, no man stood with me. Nevertheless, the Lord, he was in the valley. You can't find any valley that the Lord's not there at the present moment. I don't see them. I know all about them. You know, there's the valley of disappointment. Here, there's a thousand disappointments. You see, there's a name for God. Jehovah Shammah, which means the Lord is there. You trot out the valleys to me, the valley of misunderstanding, the valley of sorrow, valley of persecution, the valley of disappointment, the valley of the shadow. I'll be there. me, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil for thou. Don't let this curse come upon us. Don't ever let the devil in on you until you talk about the God of the past, as if he had died back there, or the God of the future, as if he's just going to awaken. Let's realize that God's name is Jehovah Shammah. He's there, you know, somewhere in the shadows. You can find him. And get this voice of victory into your soul. And get this song of salvation into your soul. And get this God of the present into your perspective. And when you turn your eyes upon Jesus and look full in his wonderful face, then the things of time and the things of the present and the things of old, they all grow strangely dim. If you're in the valley, God's with you. Don't forget that. Link your arm on his and you'll come up out of the wilderness leaning on your beloved.